This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Okay, so here it is. Here's the tree analysis, 10.11b in your syllabus. And what we're going to do is just fill things out. I'm going to start from the bottom here again. And for every time where two or more branches come together, I will add a propositional analysis of what the relationship is between these two propositions, how they support one another. Okay, so let's begin here. The sons, remember it goes back to here, the sons are full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of their God. Well, this is an incomplete proposition, grammatically speaking. But essentially, you can see from the parallelism, the sons are full of the wrath of the Lord, the sons are full of the rebuke of your God. You're saying the same thing twice. Now, in your own work, you should probably have, as you're beginning to develop your skill, have this summary of propositional relations before you, 10.26. And you ask yourself, is the relationship between these two a causal relationship, a logical relationship, a topical relationship, or a temporal relationship? Those are the four possibilities. And somebody's going to say, it's a temporal relationship. These two are simultaneous. Yeah, they are. But the temporal relationship is not in focus. This is poetry, it's not a narrative at this point, and it's parallelistic, right? So the focus is on the topical thing of saying the same thing twice. So this is the proper analysis rather than SIM, SIM, simultaneous. Of the two, which is more prominent? Well, that's quite hard to say. This one is rhetorically a little fuller because it's got the verb. On the other hand, this one, it may have a little more punch because rebuke is an alternate way of saying it. And what's more, rebuke, that is a little classier, or what shall I say? It's a little more unusual way of saying the same thing. So this is pretty balanced. This one is rhetorically got more. This one, a little sort of the what's more be. But I'm going to go for the fact that the thing is rhetorically fuller. And sometimes you'll find the things are so balanced, you say, I don't want to label one or the other. They're both equally prominent. But in this case, I'm going to label the one. Okay, now go to here. Your sons, from back in here, have lain down at the head of all the streets like an antelope, understood, caught in a net. Literally, antelope of a net. So in my own mind, I spell out what the full proposition is. Your clue is here. By the way, there's a clue here, but it is invisible. This is asyndeton, right? Now, asyndeton frequently links parallelistic stuff, and parallelistic stuff is frequently, and in other words, or maybe a but, or maybe an and. Those are very common in parallelistic lines. But here, what you've got is a kuh. Now, that's a dead giveaway, right? You've got a comparison, and you should think topical relationships like. So these two are like one another. I'll write that, like. And the like relationship has an intrinsic directionality to it. That's the arrow. In the case of the like relationship, the arrow, this is just my decision, goes from the known thing to the unknown thing. It's very frequent in communication to use analogies of various kinds. Okay, so So you're saying this case, you're trying to say something about the sons here. And you use an analogy of a known thing, namely of the experience people have with hunting and with catching antelopes, right? So they spread a net and the antelope gets caught and gets its feet caught in it. This is the known thing, and this is the new thing that you want to say by comparison. The new thing has got the prominence. And by the way, that also is confirmed by the fact which of these two has the thematic cross-references, right? Where is there any other stuff about antelopes or nets? It isn't, doesn't exist, but there's plenty about the sons and their suffering, you see. It's this one that has the cross-references. It's this one that explains why this is introduced at all. And by the way, could is also a subordinating, in this case, a preposition. And so the grammatical subordination also hints this is less prominent. So here you've got the main point of the two. And I see we reached about time to take a break. Let's take a break and we'll finish the analysis when we come back. The handout that is supposed to be your homework for Friday, somebody pointed out there's a typographical error on 11E. You won't be confused. 11E should be su, not so. Parallel to 11C. Okay, so but we're here analyzing this, okay? So the next thing to analyze is this propositional relation. Your sons have fainted. They have lain down at the head of all the streets like an antelope and the net. Conceivably, you could see this as the beginning of a mini-narrative because it's talking about various things that happened to the sons, maybe successively. The fainting, does that mean the wooziness in the head, which leads causally to falling down? You could construe it that way, but that's maybe meeting more precision into this. Is fainting, is it this the wooziness ahead, or is it the entire process of the wooziness and then the collapsing? Right? Because usually when we talk about fainting, for instance, it's not just I feel faint, you know, but I'm still walking around, but I actually did faint, you know, I fell down. So there's that, but also there's a clue here. You've got a syndeton. Narratives proceed often with vav consecutive imperfect as the main narrative continuation thing. This invites you to see these things rather as parallel. So I think on that basis, I'm saying they're saying the same thing, really, in two overlapping ways. So this is, in other words, they fainted, they lay down. And this second one has got more punch, partly because of the comparison with the antelopes. Anytime you've got a colorful comparison like that, it, you know, gives a little extra punch to that picture. It's like the situation, you know, that you give a sermon and the only thing that people remember is the illustration, which frustrates, but that's the character of illustrations that are good illustrations. Okay, so what about these two? Well, you want to look, for finding propositional relations, you want to pay attention to what the connection is. Well, here, you've just got a definite article, followed by the ones, if I translate very literally, the ones who are full of the wrath of the Lord, referring back to the sons, which are also the ones who have fallen or lain down here. All right, so this is like, it isn't in a share, but it's like a relative clause in English. you could almost translate it, who are full of the wrath of the Lord, okay? And that should make you think about a topical relationship of complement. And again, if you have your summary sheet out. In other words, contrast, like, and well, it's actually completive relationships, but they're kind of topical relationship. Complement. He thought that John was crazy, where the thought, the he thought is incomplete until you have the extra part, or he presented a gift that was tied with ribbons, right? So it's more information about the gift. In this case, it's more information about the sons, right? So here are these sons, they fainted and fallen down. Let me give you some more information about the sons, namely, they're full of wrath of the Lord. Okay, you could analyze it. This is not what I recommend, but you could analyze it. Let's see, that's F and a D and F. Okay, so you have, or D and E. Yeah, so you have D and E here. And then you have A through C here. All right, and you say complement. It goes this way, by the way, because the arrow points to this is completing a main piece here. Grammatically, this is the main piece. So it goes that way. And from a grammatical point of view, that's what's happening. Grammatically, this is like a relative clause. It gives more information about the sons, which is only a piece of this propositional cluster here. Grammatically, yeah. But very frequently, when you have this kind of thing, the information provided here is not just random extra information, but is information that is pertinent to understanding the main piece here. And there are two main propositional relations that recur again and again. One is the hence relationship, and the other is the result relationship. So this extra information may be the cause of what's here. That would be a result relationship. Or it may be a reason in the sense of logical reason for concluding that this is so. Well, which is the case here? It gets tricky, by the way, because logical reasoning is often based on cause-effect connections. If, for instance, I say, oh, I see smoke, therefore, someone must have lit a fire. What I'm doing is, you can hear the reasoning, right? And I'm trying to convince myself, or maybe convince somebody else. That's where logical relationships come in, persuasive relationships. All right, so I'm deducing the cause, namely the fire, from an effect, namely the smoke. All right, or you can go the other way and say, so-and-so just lit a fire, therefore there will soon be smoke. I'm reasoning from the cause, the fire, to the effect, the smoke. In both cases, the logical reasoning is based on an underlying cause and effect. So you could say, well, what do I do? Do I label it with a cause and effect relationship or do I label it as logical? I label it as logical because it's usually pretty easy to see there is an underlying cause and effect. But the function in the entire discourse is not merely that. It is to convince somebody, you convince yourself or convince somebody else. Is that what's happening here? Are you trying to, because the, is this a reason in the sense of a logical reason to deduce that the sons have fainted? Well, actually, no, because this is just talking about the realities of history, basically, of there's been judgment an exile. This is the underlying cause. You're not trying to persuade people of this because it's evident. If anything, you're trying to persuade them of this, which is less evident, right, of what the cause is, because it's less a matter of visibility. It is, however, the cause why the sons have fainted and fallen down. So this is a pretty clear-cut instance of a result relationship, and the reasoning goes, so if I write it out fully, result with the arrow going that way because this is the result. And 9 times out of 10, the effect is going to be more prominent because there's an intrinsic weight to the result relationship. But you always have to pause and say, is it so in this case? Well, in this case, the grammatical subordination, in effect like a relative clause, is a clue that this is more important. Again, this colorful comparison is in this part. And the main point in the context is about this disaster which affects both Jerusalem and her sons, right? So in context, that fits thematically. But somebody is going to say, wait a minute, aren't we theocentric theologians? Don't we think that God's action is more important than the human response? And my answer would be, yes, theologically, no, rhetorically, right? Because God himself has the option when he's explaining all this through Isaiah, right? He has the option what he's going to put the focus on, right? And if he wants to put the focus on what the results of his wrath are, then you just have to accept it. Okay, you know, that's what is more prominent here. So don't let your good systematic theological ideas, right? They're good, right? It is true we're theocentric. Don't let them overwhelm the text, right, which is from God himself and has its own rationale then as to, you know, why things are put the way they are. Okay, so much for that. All right, go back here. Well, there's challenges here too. Devastation and destruction, famine and sword. We looked at this before and we decided there were two disasters, right? And so that this is probably saying the same thing twice. And the second time it's more specific. Famine and sword are very specific kinds of disaster. So you're saying, but you're saying the same thing. You're not saying and as if they're additional disasters. See, the and relationship, I'm talking, that would be appropriate if we were saying, okay, devastation and destruction came, and then in addition, as a separate package, famine and sword. That would be an and relationship, a different disaster being discussed. I don't think that's here, because then you get four disasters instead of two, right? Two. But rather, you're being more specific about the same thing, right? And this is A, and what's more B, this one being the more specific, giving added emphasis to it. Now there's a challenge here because this is not a statement. It is a question. How may I comfort you? Remember, this is normally who, right? But with the first person, in a sense, how may I comfort you? Question. What do you do with that? Well, propositional relations work directly with statements or statement-like material, not with questions. Now, there's two kinds of questions, two main kinds. One is a question from one person that gets an answer from a second person. And that's really a cause and effect relationship, right? The cause is the question and the answer is, you know, the response is obviously the effect that's responding to the initial question. That's with real questions to get real answers from second person. This one is what's called a rhetorical question because it doesn't really expect an answer, right? Isaiah, if he's preaching this orally, well, clearly in the written text it's even worse, right? He's not waiting, pausing until somebody reading over his shoulder is saying, well, I can answer that, you know. And the answer, a rhetorical question, the answer is obvious. It's intended to be obvious. How may I comfort the answer? No way. The point is, there's, and here's a parallel one, who will console you? Nobody, because the sons have the same problem. So what I do with a rhetorical question is to translate it into the equivalent statement. What's the point? It is, there is no comfort. And how does that fit into the disaster? Well, when the disaster happens, you would expect that there would be some response from sympathetic bystanders or even more, a relative, right? So the woman experiences disaster. The sons are going to be there to help her out, to take care of her until she recovers, you would think, right? But of course, the sons, they're in no condition, right? They're experiencing disaster themselves, so they're not there. So this is a natural structure of response, which is a kind of cause-effect relationship. I probably should say, cause-effect relationships are various kinds. If I shoot a billiard ball and it hits another ball, the first ball is the cause and the second ball is the motion, that's the effect. The second ball doesn't really have any choice about the matter. But with people, responses have a choice element in them, human responsibility. So and I still classify that, however, as a cause and effect, even though the effect is not guaranteed, right? It's not a mechanical effect like billiard balls. So it's still cause and effect, and that means I should label this result like so. Result. And the question is, which is more prominent? Well, in a result relationship, the effect has a natural weight to it. But in addition, a rhetorical question, over and over again, a rhetorical question stands out. And one of the points of a rhetorical question is to make you think, to engage you more than just an out-and-out statement. And that makes it more prominent, typically. So that's a significant clue. All right, disaster comes without comfort. And this the same way, right? Two things have happened to you, and then who will console you? Answer, no one will console you, right, if I change that into a statement, right? And again, that would be a natural response. Though the alternative, I just realized it, and we could debate this, would be an although kind of situation. Because you would expect normal, in terms of normal situations, that there would be some relative or friend to help out. But I don't see that as a particularly surprising. It's just intensifying the suffering, right? Disasters happen, and what's more, there's nobody even to mitigate, to make the disaster less disastrous. All right, and you're saying the same thing twice here, right, in parallel lines, right? Both two rhetorical questions, two mentions of the disaster, clearly parallel. And the second time, it is more specific what exactly has happened. This first time, it's pretty colorless. Two things have happened. What things? You don't know until you come here. So it's pretty clear that this second time you're saying this has got the emphasis. And what about here? Here's disaster, and we really got to take the big picture to understand it fully. Disaster comes to Jerusalem. And here, disaster comes to the sons. And somebody's going to say, well, that's the same disaster. Because what we're talking about is the Babylonian exile. right? And Nebuchadnezzar coming with his army, he besieges Jerusalem, he takes it, destroys it, and with that, he destroys the city, which is, in effect, the woman here, and he destroys her inhabitants, that is, the sons. So it's all of a piece, right? So you could say he's just describing the same thing twice. In other words, relationship. Not quite, because when I have something like this, I want to take into account the fact, the metaphorical character of it, not to reduce it, oh, well, you're just talking twice about the disaster on a whole city and its inhabitants, right? That it's true on one level. You can boil it down to that when you, you know, remove all the metaphors. But I don't want to remove the metaphors. I want to think about them and appreciate them, okay? And on the level of metaphor, these are two different events, right? An event against the woman and an event against the sons. They're parallel. They're obviously topically related. They're obviously simultaneous, right? But again, temporal relationship. This is not a narrative of the fall of Jerusalem like you found in the end of 2 Kings. It's not that. It's poetry, right? You're not focusing on the temporal relationship so much as disaster, disaster, right? But two different disasters. So it's an and relationship rather than in other words. Right? If it's the same disaster, you're just recording the same thing twice. And which of the two is more prominent? That's kind of hard to say. They're about equal amount of space on the page. Where's the focus in the whole passage? Is it on the sons? Is it on Jerusalem? It's both. But if you go way back to the very beginning, rouse yourself. That's second feminine singular. You're talking about Jerusalem. Arise, Jerusalem. Right, Jerusalem is what motivates the bringing in the discussion of the sons. So I think the disaster to Jerusalem is in fact the more prominent of the two. But to see that, I've got to look at the whole passage. Right, you will not necessarily every time find a clear clue. Oh, by the way, this is reinforced by the question of, what's the connector here? The answer, asyndeton, no explicit conjunction. Right? And that's typical of the way poetry represents an and relationship. So, okay, you and your sons and the disaster to Jerusalem being more prominent of the two. All right, let's keep going back then. There is none. There's none to take her by the hand from all the sons which she raised. Grammatically, this is a subordinate clause. So, that provides more information about the sons. So think complement relation. But once again, is this a cause? Is this a basis of a logical reasoning for this? Well, it's clearly not random information. It's more poignant because the very sons that she cared for, you know, it's kind of like the Mother's Day reflections. The very sons she cared for, you know, they have an obligation to their mom. But they're nowhere to be seen. So it's not random information, but it's best classified as still giving more information about the sons. And in a complement relationship, this is the way you do it. The main piece is where the arrow points. And something like four times out of five, at least, the main piece grammatically is also the more prominent. Is the discussion in the context about the history of Jerusalem in relation to her sons? Not really, right? The discussion in context is about whether there's anybody to help Jerusalem out, right? And so this is definitely not the main point. The main point is there's none to guide her. Similarly here, same structure, parallel, right? Complement relationship. The main point, there's no one to guide her, and you're saying the same thing twice, the second time around, a little more poignant, because there's a vividness in taking her by the hand. And it's just a vivid picture that is more powerful than a simple statement, there's none to guide her. Okay, go back here. The goblet cup of staggering, you have drunk, you are drained. How do we deal with that? Well, asyndeton right here. You could say these two are saying the same thing twice with a greater, greater emphasis here because it's drink to the very bottom. On the other hand, that second one is almost functioning like an adverb. You have drunk to the bottom. So I'm dealing with it as giving more information about one thing, namely the verb, you have drunk, and that the main point being here. The alternative would just say the main point is here to the bottom and to say you're saying the same thing twice. All right, now what about here? We've got a parallelism, right? You have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, the goblet cup of staggering you've drunk, you've drained. You're saying the same thing twice. The second time around, you've drunk to the bottom. More emphasis there. And now we got this part. You've drunk the cup of God's wrath, and the sons come in, right? Here's, again, Jerusalem and her sons, two parallel pieces, right? The disaster is made more vivid by bringing in the fact there are two disasters, right? One, the drinking the cup of God's wrath, and the other having no sons to help. And the focus on Jerusalem is, again, the more important. The sons are brought in for her sake rather than the other way around. And what about here? It seems to me you're just saying the same thing twice. And of the two, which is more important? Well, here, I think, you've got more details. You've got details about the kind of disaster that you're talking about, and you've got details about why the sons are unavailable. Right? Here, you're just saying the sons are not available. Here's why. So you fill in some detail. And then back here, rouse yourself. Oh boy, very clear case of saying the same thing twice. And you say, well, how in the world can one be more prominent than the other? Because it's the same thing. But the first time you say it, it's new. And the second time, it's just reinforcing what you already said. So there's reason to think that, again, as you think about how a passage like that impacts people and how the author intends it to impact, it's this thing that stands out and is reinforced by the second one. And then, arise, Jerusalem, you're again saying the same thing, and because you repeated it, you have a double the first time, that stands out a little more. So there you are. Now, if you're going to preach this, you want to take into account not only the pieces, so here's a possible sermon outline, right? But the prominence. And by the way, if you start at the root of the tree and you follow the tree down, and each time take the root, you choose the one that's more prominent, you should come out at something that is like the main point of the passage. And in this case, it is disaster without comfort. You really, I mean, this is intelligible only with this. But that that is the overall, close to the overall theme of the entire passage. Okay. So, let's do one more so you get a little more practice seeing how the propositions relate. And I know, you know, for some of you, if you've done this a lot in Greek, you may be tired of it, but my categories are a little bit different. So, we're going to do one more passage, Isaiah 51, 21 to 23. And once again, we start with a completed tree diagram, right? So 10.11D is where you have it, and you can write on it if you want. And we're going toward 10.30B, where you will see that the result is been filled out. But pretend that you don't know about that, right? And we'll work it from the bottom up. You put your back like the ground and like the street for those passing over. Now, you can take this as a separate proposition, or you could just unite it, in which case, if this is all one, then you, of course, you don't need to worry about propositional relations. But if you broke it off, how would you describe the propositional relations? You describe it as a complement relation, because this is giving more information about the benefactor of this whole clause. But the main point is, you bow down. All right, bow down in order that we may pass over. That's an intending relationship. We researched that, you may remember, right, with this cohortative, na'avora. We researched what the significance is when you follow have an imperative followed by a cohortative with a weak vav. And the answer is purpose. And at this point, the command is given, bow down in order that we may pass over. By itself, that doesn't indicate whether the people, the captors, did, tormentors did pass over or not. So at this point, it is intending. And the main point, in intending relationship over and over again, has an intrinsic weight, and it's actually the cause that is, generally speaking, more prominent. In this case, this vav makes this one subordinate to this, grammatically even. And if you ask, what's the main thing here in terms of relationships, well, the command is to bow down, and then they did bow down, right? Yeah, there was passing over, but that's not the main point. The main point is this humiliation of Israel, which was carried out by the tormentors. So that makes sense that this is the more prominent. Not much is made of the fact they actually did pass over. And then what about this one? They said to your soul, quote, right, if you use quotation marks, you'd begin them here, right, and end them here. And this is an incomplete proposition. If you want to analyze it grammatically, they said, right, and then maybe to your soul. But what they said has got to be here. They said something. What did they say? They said this. So there's actually, if you represent it in a sentence diagram, you would put the whole sequence of two clauses there, the, what is it, D and E, you would put that as functioning as the object of the verb, saying. Now, this is one typical case of a complement relationship where you've got an incomplete proposition and then you fill out the information about this one part. So you write that this way. complement. And you will say, okay, the complement relationship has an intrinsic prominence. It is grammatically superordinate, this part is, as well as intrinsic prominence, pointing to the fact this is the main, this is the prominent part. Answer, no, this is an exception. With speeches, hopes, thoughts, intentions, there's a whole category, large category of things that are regularly are exceptions to the general tendency that the grammatical superordinate thing and that includes it is the more prominent. Because if you think about it, when you're introducing something like this, and the linguists, some of them have called it an orienter, you're identifying who's saying what to whom, but the content over and over again is what you really want to know. So this is a regular exception to the sort of rule of thumb that in a complement relationship, it's the grammatically superordinate thing that is more prominent. You want to put the emphasis here. Here's what they said, the content, right? And then the response is, and this is a clear case of result. No, it's I put it retending. Yeah, this is, it's a case where you can further divide this, because sometimes intending relationships, it is actually implied that the intention is fulfilled. Other cases, like this one, right, it's you can't deduce whether it's fulfilled or not. What is distinctive, and it's the difference between, there's a purpose, in Greek discourse, a purpose relationship and means end relationship. I'm just collapsing them into intending. But in this case, yeah, you can tell that they bowed down, but the intention is clearly there. It's not simply, oh, this is a cause like a billiard ball, right, that results in this. But somebody actually intended here, right, clearly this is an order. The idea of intentionality is built in. So that's what motivates me. If it's just a cause and effect, then there's no visible stress on intention. Then it's just result. But in this case, you've clearly got an intention, and which of the two is more important? And I'm saying it is this one. It's the cruelty of the oppressors that is the main thing. Now, you could dispute that, but I think that's why this whole thing is there. And it fits in with what's here because God's judgment as a judge has two components. One is to relieve the oppression and the suffering of his people. The other part is to punish the oppressors. And this part is that you need to have that motivation of explaining what the oppressors did. Okay, so go back here. I will put her, that is the wrath, into the hand of your tormentors. Well, this is really grammatically a piece of, it's explaining what the, who's going to receive this, right? It's a piece of a main proposition, and the main proposition here has got the prominence. And what about here? Behold, I have taken from your hand the cup of staggering, the goblet cup of my wrath you will never drink again. You're saying that same thing, although the second time you're saying it negatively, never again, and here you're saying it positive, I've taken it away from you. Generally speaking, if you have this kind of, it's actually, it's a little tricky because you can say, okay, if you've got two things, one of which is a positive statement, the other is a negative statement, you've got a but relationship, not necessarily. Because if you're saying the same thing, once positively, the other negative, you're really just, you are still saying the same thing. So it's an in other words relationship. And something like 9 times out of 10, the positive pole will be more prominent. It's kind of a natural thing about human communication, right? The negative is there to represent a kind of negative pole to reinforce the positive. In this case, however, I think it's different because there's stress on the fact you will never have to drink it again. Not again to drink again. And this has got this extra kind of $10 world, kaba'at, which is more rare as well, which says, and what's more, be. There's emphasis, I think, there. Okay? And by the way, look here. There's asyndeton and chiastic parallelism, but which reinforces the expectation you're saying the same thing. What about here? Look what's happening here. It's a vav plus a perfect of a future promised action. I will put her. And that's like a future narrative, isn't it? You don't see that very often in poetic passages. But what you've got is the beginning of a narrative. So you should think, maybe time, right? So I've got this as earlier and this is later, and it's an after relationship. But the two are not only related as before and after, but there's an intentionality. Part of the intention of taking the cup away from the suffering people is in order to then put it into this hand. So I think implicit in that is not only before and after, but intentionality. And when that happens, you see, you could say, okay, this is just before and after. But frequently, before and after relationships have imposed over them a cause-effect of various kinds. And I think that's happening here. It's pretty visible, right, that clearly the two things are related causally, not just one succeeding one or the other in time, although that's true enough. Of the two, which is more important? Hard to say. But if I have to choose, what's more important? If you're suffering, is it to know that you're going to be relieved of your suffering or to know that your enemies are going to get it in the teeth? I think it's the relief from suffering. Okay. And then here, what's the proposition relationship here? Well, go down here and you see a share, which is pretty colorless. And you'd say, you can look at this as almost like a relative clause, right? If it were prose, it would be a subordination and saying, okay, I'm giving more information about the tormentors and what they did. They said to your soul, X, Y, Z, right? So more information about this piece. But is it random information? Clearly not. And we've talked about the fact already. This is really the grounds for the judgment God concludes up here. So you've got really a logical relationship. And it's reinforced by the fact way up there, right, of God is going to plead the cause of his people. This is set in a kind of judicial context. So here's the evidence. And here's the judgment concluding that the judge says, okay, here's what's happened, and this is the basis why I'm going to do this. It's a reasoning relationship, and we say, hence. And 9 times out of 10, this is pretty reliable. With a reasoning relationship like this, it is the conclusion that you're headed for that explains everything else. You can see, you know, that's kind of a natural thing in discourses. And is that true here, right? Are you really focused in the end, in the entire passage, so much on what the oppressors did or what the judgment conclusion is? That's really the essential heart of it, isn't it?
Okay, so thus says your Lord, the Lord, and God will plead for his people. You're saying the same thing twice, but more specifically with this special verb, reev, in the second time. And then the content is the speech, right? Thus says your Lord, the Lord. Well, what does he say? And you see, this is kind of a placeholder, the ko, thus, that's filled by this piece here. It's a clear case of a complement relationship. And you're going to say, okay, this is grammatically superordinate, right? And complement relation has a natural weight in this direction. This is more prominent. No, it's again one of these things of saying, right? It's the content of what is said that is going to be the heart of the matter. Okay, now go back here. Therefore, hear please this, afflicted and drunk with not with wine. The drunkenness is the more specific form of affliction. It's not two different afflictions. And this is providing more information about the person being addressed. It's a clear case of a complement relationship where this is the main point. Now, the information, as usual, is not random information, right? It's making it more important to listen because you've got to be encouraged. So it makes sense, right, why this information is included, but it's not the reason exactly or the cause of listening. All right, one more thing then. Here, what are you supposed to hear? The content of what is heard? It's a complement relationship, and once again, it is the content that is all important. And actually, I've labeled it a little bit differently, introduction and body. The fact is, you can introduce your own categories if you feel it's, you know, something more sophisticated is going on in a particular thing, because this is, it is like a kind of introduction to a gigantic speech. But if I have to use the old categories, this is the way I would do it, and I see we're out of time. So, okay, you've had some examples of this, and we will continue with rhetorical analysis, God willing, on Friday. So remember, you have an assignment for Friday.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.